To the ancient philosopher, however, the flowering of plants, the propagation of species, the tinting of rocks and crystals, the motions of the elements, and the emotions of the soul all. These were regarded alike as evidence of the presence of invisible, but powerful spirits, daemons, who, seated in the causal nature of the manifesting sphere, guided primitive lives to the fulfillment of the predestined ends of universal procedure. Some of these daemons are analogous to the elemental spirits of Paracelsus, with whose characteristics the great Swiss physician was made familiar by Arabian sorcerers. Recognizing all diversified activities to be suspended from causal unities, the philosopher of antiquity realized that while green, for example, dominates the color scheme of numberless organisms, green is itself a monad or unity, its intrinsic nature being coetaneous with the rational daemon. The orderly or rational distribution of green is thus effected through the ministrations of this guardian spirit, which is synonymous with the very nature of green itself. To attribute rationality to a tube of pigment at first may appear to be a baseless concept. Those who have experimented most with colors realize, however, that they have an inherent orderliness and are very much alive, possessing the power to excite pleasure or displeasure, and through their intermingling to demonstrate various complexions of universal order. As the salamander is born by the very friction that ignites the sulfur match, so a daemon is spontaneously produced through every combination of forces, substances, or circumstances, becoming the patron of such combinations and remaining with them until divine procedure returns these combinations to their original simplicity. Emerson's concept of the Oversoul, 293. 294 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. The belief in guardian spirits is a very lofty one when the unfolding rationality of man permits him to regard these entities as ever beautiful and virtuous. On the other hand, untutored peoples consider these transcendental entities to be innately malevolent, conspiring against human beings and seeking to spread sorrow and mischief throughout the world. The idealism of the Greek aesthetic aeons enabled them to recognize divine agency in all that was beautiful, in that divinities rejoiced in the harmonious combinations of substances and circumstances. Accordingly, a place of beauty must needs be the dwelling of a thing of beauty. In somber groves dwelt grave dryads formed of the soft shadow that lingered there. In the high-flung spray of waterfalls nymphs disport themselves, while diminutive but pompous gnomes industriously hoarded beechnuts against the possibility of 7 lean years. Though these creatures were invisible to the normal sight, man was conscious of their presence. They were indeed creations of place, the products of environment and necessary to the setting of the picture. All these creatures are daemons of different orders, for there are not only vast spirits whose bodies are stars, but daemons so small that they seek the shelter of toad stools or play hide and seek among the blades of grass. The daemon is the spirit of feeling that is born of, and is inseparable from, the circumstance that gives it birth. It is the preserver of universal order in the lesser, the untiring minister to parts, the protector and patron of unfolding life. Just what relation, then, does the Oversoul of Emerson bear to the God of Socrates, that strange yet exalted spirit which impelled the Athenian commoner to a martyr's end? Emerson, the Occidental Orientalist, thus defines what he conceives to be that common Oversoul of whose nature we all partake, and which is the common measure of us all, the supreme critic on all the errors of the past and the present, and the only prophet of that which must be, is that great nature in which we rest, as the earth lies in the soft arms of the atmosphere. That unity, that oversoul, within which every man's particular being is contained and made one with all other, that common. Emerson's concept of the oversoul. 295. Heart, of which all sincere conversation is the worship, to which all right action is submission, that overpowering reality which confutes our tricks and talents, and constrains every one to pass for what he is, and to speak from his character and not from his tongue, and which evermore tends and aims to pass into our thought and hand, and become wisdom, and virtue, and power, and beauty. It is a philosophic axiom that as we verge toward cause we verge toward simplicity, and as we depart from cause we incline toward complexity, for all things are simple in their beginnings, complex in their midmost parts, and simple again in their ends. As man passes from childishness through maturity to childishness, so life, according to the doctrines of Herbert Spencer, is from simple homogeneity to complex heterogeneity, and from heterogeneity back again to homogeneity. Approach to simplicity, then, presumes an ever-decreasing number of parts, until ultimate simplicity is utter privation of partition. Emerson clearly senses the common unity of cause, that vast monad which is our common parent and whose sufficiency is the one noble reality. This is indeed the great daemon, the supreme soul invoked by existence, whose minis trations we manifest in common and whose edicts are the code of our lives. As we increase in rationality, we become diffused among or enter into the inner nature of an ever-increasing number of organisms, thereby becoming capable of knowing and feeling the impulses which actuate these organizations. Thus man became the oversoul of men, the atom, or archetypal one from whom issue the many, the protogonas from whose nature as from the pores of the skin come forth the sweatborn and the establishment of generations. Thus man the oversoul is the anthropo, or demoniacal spirit which is the common father of infinite progeny, the vast sphere of influence which men can never escape, but which is their allness and against the sovereignty of which they vainly struggle, ignorant of the fact that it is their common life. The oversoul alone is man, for men are but fractional. 296 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Parts of themselves and are never complete until all together form one grand nature. Therefore, while all men differ in their outer lives, in their inner life there is this common ground whereon all stand together and upon which they must erect the citadel of their strength. Only to the dreamer, who sees not with his eyes, but with his soul, is the dignity of the anthropo apparent. Only the mystic can comprehend that vast being which towers above the puny sensibilities of mortals and from the lofty place broods over the body of its sovereignty. This anthropo exceeds men to the degree that the whole exceeds its parts, for each part contributes to the sufficiency of the sum. The Neoplatonists differed from the Egyptians in their definition of the anthropo, or the nature of the all-containing self, when related to the status of men. According to one group, all of man descends into the sphere of generation, there to wander for a given time in the confusion of sense, and later by rational procedure to escape therefrom and reascend to the sphere of spiritual sufficiency. The more profound philosophies, however, declared that the ungenerate can never actually generate, nor can that which abides in the contemplation of poor affection ever become immersed in the delusions of mortality. While the inferior nature of man, suspended from its monadic cause, may thus struggle for a brief period in the darkness of the moral sphere, the true self remains throughout this period in the presence of perfect order and adequate comprehension. According to this viewpoint, all of man does not descend into the realm of his corporeal limitations, but rather broods over the incarnating part, and from its own state of detachment, contemplates the attachments which involve the inferior self. Thus man is more than man, he is like the oft-employed simile of the iceberg, of which only a fractional part of its great bulk is visible. This invisible greatness of man, unmoved and uninvolved, and residing in the pure rationality of the supreme sphere, is termed the silent watcher, the Atman, who is the true man, and of whom the lesser part becomes increasingly aware as it ceases to be conscious in its animal part. In this manner is man, the comparative physical non-entity, suspended from man, the actual spiritual immensity. Is it not this over brooding divinity which man senses when he explores the depths of his own feeling and seeks to measure the magnitude of his intellect? Is it not this transcendent superpersonal one who is the true substance of man's hope and the body of his aspirations? Picture, then, the mortal nature of man who, obscured by the insufficiency of his physical perceptions and crawling worm, like upon the surface of earth, dares to believe in his own thoughts and assume the reasonableness of his own contentions. Then conceive the blind mortality which men call life, to be directed by a great and observing spirit which, grasping the lesser life by the hand, gently leads it toward comprehension and realization. Imagine that behind the little you at all times stands the greater you, majestic, illumined, magnificent, who communicates to the earthiness which is your mortal body a splendor more than sufficient, and through whose greatness the little you is made partaker of the greatness and goodness of all things. This is the Anthropo, the heavenly man, the supreme Manu, from whose presence man departs for his terrestrial wandering in the prodigal sphere. While Emerson conceives the soul to be within man, in philosophy we prefer to conceive of man as within this soul. As through philosophy we increase the dimensions of our internal selves, we gradually annihilate the interval between our human souls and this oversoul. Our internal selves take on the stature of this nobler part until, though our body be still of mortal size, the scope of expanding consciousness becomes shins of inspiration. We then understand the qualities which